thank you. Into the 9 o'clock hour we go. Melanie Talia joins us, President and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. Talk about drones. How you doing, Melanie?
I'm well, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I am okay. Tell people that don't know, perhaps, about the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation.
Sure. We've been around for 30-plus years. Our mission is to make New Orleans a safer place to live, to work, and to play. And we do that through a variety of means, mostly training, advanced training for our police officers, and providing equipment and supplies that, for whatever reason, are just not in the municipal budget.
And some of those equipment and supplies, I guess it'd be somewhere between manpower, equipment, and supplies when you're talking about drones, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the drones in some places are the wave of the future, and in other places, drones have been around for a really long time. But they've impacted public safety in tremendous ways. They've really made a difference in the cities where they have been used. And we've even seen that here in New Orleans with the fleet of 9 that we've had for about 2 years now.
So what are you guys going to do? What are you donating or providing?
So the city is looking at drones as first responders. So when a 911 call comes out, while an officer might be dispatched, an officer may not. The first responder to that scene or to that call would be a drone. And it's DFR is the short term for it. Mm-hmm. DFRs are being used around the country, and they're
drone
being used
first responder, I'm guessing?
Yes. Okay. Yes, drones as first responders.
Gotcha.
You're being used extensively in our neighboring parish in Jefferson. So the city is looking at a pilot project, drones as first responders, in the NOPD 8th district, which includes the French Quarter.
So I'm trying to figure out how that works. So the drone goes out, and does it interact with the people, or it just takes a picture or shows the people back at drone control what's going on, and then they figure out from there what they need to do?
More or less, that's more or less how it works, Tommy. Yes, so the 911 call comes out. A pilot who is in the command center will launch the drone, and the drone will fly immediately to the scene of that call, and the drone will be able to assess the situation. It may be a situation where a police officer is not required. It could be someone who needs mental health services or some other service. That doesn't mean you need to dispatch an officer, in which case officers can go about their business doing other things. If it is a scene where an officer needs to be dispatched, of course, an officer will be dispatched. It's a great tool, and we've seen it used oftentimes to track a fleeing suspect. So obviously the drone would be able to see a fleeing suspect much more quickly than would an officer who's on the ground, be that officer on foot or in a car. And of course, we all know that the French Quarter gets mighty crowded sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the drone can get from point A to point B much more quickly. Obviously, it avoids all the foot traffic and the vehicular traffic.
So how expensive are these things, Melanie?
Well, it varies depending upon the drone and how many drones you have and how many docking stations you have and how you anticipate using them. Mm-hmm. The pilot project that the city is considering has a price tag all in of about $750,000 over the course of 5 years.
And how many drones are we talking about?
Ideally, it would be 4. I mean, 1 is great, but, you know, drones have limited flying power mm-hmm. and limited flying time. So an investigation might take longer than that drone is able to stay up in the air. So it's always good to have at least 1 backup. But we're looking at, ideally, we would have 4.
So they like $250,000 each?
Give or, well, $750 over the course of 5 years. So, yes, give or take. That's a kind of a round number, yes.
And I'm just, you know, my kid's got a drone. I certainly hope it didn't cost that much. This is some kind of, I guess, commercial grade or something. I'm just trying to figure out the drone thing here, why it's so much.
Yes. It would be a commercial grade. And they would be funded exclusively with, at least the 3 that we would fund, are funded exclusively with private monies. There's no public monies involved here. It's a pilot project. The drones can fly about 20-ish, 25 miles maybe per hour. They can stay up about 20 to 40 minutes, depending. So they obviously have capabilities that go beyond the, you know, a drone that we might just have at home for our children or to take out to a picnic somewhere.
Mm-hmm. What does NOPD say about these things?
Well, the New Orleans Police Department is definitely on board for drones as first responders. Captain Palumbo in the NOPD 8th District has been spearheading the project on NOPD's behalf.
And these are primarily used as first responders or only as first responders?
Absolutely. They are used as first responders. You know, I think there's a lot of confusion about license plate readers, sometimes referred to as LPRs. Folks are talking about facial recognition. They're talking about surveillance. That is not drone as first responder. A drone as first responder, the device sits in its docking station, or for all practical purposes, its battery. When the 911 call comes out, the drone is launched by a pilot who flies it directly to that location and then does whatever needs doing to manage that scene.
Tell me about some of the other needs of NOPD and what you all are looking at.
Sure. You know, one of the things we recently launched was the Emergency Medical Responder Program. There was a gap in public safety where emergency medical services are not always allowed into a scene. That's their official protocol because the scene is not safe for the EMS workers. So we have now cross-trained New Orleans police officers in life-saving treatments. So if EMS is not allowed on a scene or if NOPD is on the scene first, officers are able to provide life-sustaining methods and life-sustaining means to persons who have been victims of oftentimes violent crimes where every minute counts, Tommy, every minute.
So there
and
might be.
Also,
go ahead, Melanie.
Okay.
I didn't mean to interrupt. No, I'm just saying, so it's a situation where maybe the shooter might still be around. I don't know what's going on. A crime scene's not secure, but somebody needs help. So rather than wait until it's safe for EMT, that's when the police take over?
Absolutely. And that's a great example where a drone would be a wonderful tool to have. Right now, if a call comes out, you have to wait, obviously, for the officer or the EMS or the fire department to come on scene and to begin making assessments. Because drones can get to scene so much more quickly, then you have an eye in the sky that can tell you the scene is secure or the scene is not secure. We need EMS. We need fire. Perhaps there's traffic. Perhaps there's a different way we need to route emergency vehicles to get to you and to save your life.
When it comes to money, how do you guys raise your money?
We are primarily funded through private donors.
And if somebody wants to get involved with that, how would they do it?
They just go to nopjf.org. We have an online donation process, and they can donate to any of their favorite NOPD districts or units or projects, including if they are interested in supporting drones as first responders.
So getting back to what we were talking about, some of the other things you're helping with, one of them is to train officers as medical respondents?
Correct, emergency medical responders.
And what are some of the other things, Melanie, you all are looking at or doing or have done?
Well, you know what? We're working on a project right now. The New Orleans Police Department has put out an alert for a missing individual. I believe he's a young man of about 22 years old. And one of the things the Police Foundation does is we work in partnership with Lamar Billboards and with Ring. We push out that information so that it can go up on billboards across the city and beyond. And so that if the individual happened to be on a Ring camera somewhere, that they also might be located. The individual that NOPD is searching for right now is Kamon Terrell. We do believe he is in danger. So we hope that we find him quickly and safely and bring him home.
You guys help at Mardi Gras, too. You do a lot of stuff, don't you?
We do a lot at Mardi Gras, including making sure all of our first responders, be they New Orleans Police Department or visiting law enforcement, have food and hydration, get a chance to get off the street where they can, get some rest, and get back to it. Because it takes a lot to ensure the revelry of Mardi Gras and that everyone is safe and secure.
If somebody's listening and they're on a fence right now about donating or not, what would you tell them?
I would tell them absolutely. You know, we have seen tremendous progress in the New Orleans Police Department. In 2022, with some political, not some political, I'm sorry, some public safety strategists that the Police Foundation engaged, we started to see a reduction in crime. Chief Kirkpatrick has come. She built on that foundation. She brought her own strategies. And we are seeing it, Tommy. We're seeing it work year over year. Violent crime numbers going down year over year. Homicides, armed robberies. The list goes on. Chief Kirkpatrick and her team are doing an incredible job, but we are all feeling the crunch of the fiscal crisis, and they are going to need our help. So if you are able to assist canine mounted officers in your district, we would encourage you to do so.
And that would be how? A cash donation? Or how do they send a check somewhere? What do they do? I'm trying to raise some money for you here, Melanie. And I'm trying to.
Well, that's, I appreciate that. Yes, we can go online. The website is NOPJF, as in New Orleans Police Justice Foundation, .org. And it's a very easy process to go online. You put in your credit card and you make a donation. Every dime fights crime. Every dime. No donation is too small, Tommy. No donation.
Thank you, Melanie. I appreciate it. That and your efforts.
All right. Thank you, Tommy. We appreciate everything you do as well.
Thank you. Melanie Italia, President and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation, making our way through this Tuesday morning, August the 18th. We started talking to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, talking about LSU fall practice and a video that was posted that Lane Kiffin wasn't crazy about that was taken down. You can go back, listen to that if you like. Cameron Henry was with us, Louisiana State Senator and Senate President. We spoke with him about the convention center hotel project and some of the details that have to be worked out and how this tax credit thing could go on for 45 years. We talked with David Elias, Dr. David Elias, an orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA, about Jordan Tyson and his hamstring injury and hamstring injuries in general and why they can be so problematic. Then we talked with Steve Geller, WWL sports director, about the joint practices, what he's seen, what stood out to him and what hasn't. Greg Upton, director of LSU's Energy Institute, was with us talking about wind and how that's dead for all intents and purposes off the coast of the United States. And J.P. Moreau was here talking about the status of the Plaza Tower. And I say all of that because if you missed any of it, it's as easy as using the Rewind feature. Free Odyssey app has a great feature called Rewind. If you missed part of an interview, stepped away during a breaking news story, just jump back and catch exactly what you missed. Download that free Odyssey app, search for WWL, and listen on your schedule. Rewind, another reason why the Odyssey app belongs on your phone. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to keep going with Judy Ho, a licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast. And I'm going to get your input on this at 504-260-1870. Half of the parents in the United States say they sometimes go through their kids' phones. Do you? Where's the line between snooping, giving them privacy, and keeping them safe? We'll get some answers, get some tips here, your feedback when we come back on WWL. 9:28 now, talking to Dr. Judy Hoag, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, our longtime friend. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm well. We're going to talk about parents and smartphones, although we're really talking about phones and mental health here for the most part, aren't we?
Of course. Everyone's favorite topic.
Tell me about how they can negatively impact kids.
Well, the thing is that phones are just so high stimuli and things are happening so fast and people can scroll and switch in between content really fast and also simultaneously look at a bunch of content at the same time. And what we know about developing brains especially is that it will oftentimes impede the proper development of our executive functions and our attention stores. So even as adults, you know, we may feel sometimes overwhelmed by all of that. And as children, because the brains are still under construction, it has a bigger impact that could end up carrying into other things that they need to do throughout the day, the tasks that they need to complete, and also just contributes to a sense of feeling overwhelmed, rushed, like there's just too much going on at the same time.
And even phone is a misnomer because it's really like carrying a little computer around with you. That's what we're talking about.
Exactly. I know it's so complicated. I still remember when we had, you know, rotary phones in the home.
No, really, you don't. You might remember push button. You don't remember rotary phones.
I had a rotary phone when I was very little growing up in Taiwan. There's a picture of me with it when I was like 4 years old.
So it's not all bad. It can be good, right?
Of course. I mean, phones, you know, again, like you just said, phones are a little computer. So there's a lot that we can accomplish with our phones. But I think a lot of people are not necessarily using their phones for productivity. And even sometimes the productivity apps on a phone can get kind of overwhelming. Like there's just too many things happening. Mm-hmm. And of course, phones help us keep in touch. Phones help us to stay on top of the news and any updates. All those things are great, but I also have people complaining that they feel like they're too connected. Like sometimes they really just want to be away from their phones, but people always know how to reach them even when they're on a vacation, you know, and this applies to kids too, right? I mean, maybe they are trying to just, you know, have a nice day with the family. But they keep checking Instagram or TikTok to see what they're missing because they know that their friends are out today and they're worried that their friends are doing something super fun without them. And that contributes to anxiety and that feeling of FOMO that a lot of people complain about.
And as far as super fun, I'd put that in quotation marks because, you know, 12 seconds might look like super fun, but that's just 12 seconds out of God knows how much, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that is, unfortunately, you know, you fill in the blanks, right? You see the 12 seconds on a reel or on a TikTok video, but you fill in the blanks of, oh my gosh, you know, and when the camera's not on, they're saying this or doing that, and I'm missing all of it.
It's just like a TV program is what it is, and I don't think kids realize that. Is there something parents can do or should do, like at what's age appropriate for a child to sit down and say, look, now, here's the deal. What you're watching is not real. In a way it is, but in a way it's not, and at some point, they have to have a reality check, right? It seems like earlier would be better than later.
Oh, definitely. But I think that it can be tough, right? Because sometimes when you have that talk with your kids, they think that you're the one who's out of touch. You have no idea what they're going through. And, you know, to an extent, they're probably right. And also, once you start to talk to them in a sort of, you know, I got to talk to you, this is a lecture kind of way, they just kind of tune you out. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's, you got to find that right approach. And I think so much of it really revolves around staying curious and being curious about their habits, why they use the phone, you know, why they're interested, but not making it seem like an interrogation and seem more like a conversation where you're trying to learn about their interests, why they use the phone, why it's important to them, you know, what they think the benefits are. I think that it has to sort of bridge that feeling of I'm getting a lecture from my parents to, oh, my mom and my dad, they just really want to know about my life.
As you say that, I'm just thinking about the conversation, how it's evolved through the years with the phones. And you know, I've been watching Breaking Bad and what's the other one? Better Call Saul. And they got their old flip phones, right? And you think about how much that's changed with the iPhone, a smartphone. And then the concern used to be with predators and young people, and it still is. But now it's almost the threat is not as much a predator as much as it is just the social backlash, right? One way or the other?
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of times people are thinking about, you know, of course, those dangers, those big dangers that you just mentioned. But it's also the fact that with our phones, we're constantly feeling connected to anything that might be going on, any potential gossip, people bullying you in the comments, you know, making snide remarks, making you feel bad about yourself. And sometimes they're even sending things more in a direct message. Or if you're using Snapchat, whatever mean thing they said about you, it goes away after a period of time and you can't even track it. And so I think that all of that adds up to a lot of pressure and could have really significant mental health consequences, especially for our young people, because at a certain age, we care about peer influence and we care about peer interactions much more so than we do as adults. And that's that time when all these comments matter so much more.
You have a soon-to-be 5-year-old, right?
My child is 4 and a half.
Soon to be five.
I mean, he already is feeling some. Yeah, he's about to be 5. Exactly.
Soon to be 5.
You know, he's already feels Yeah, he's going to be 5 in November. So yeah. he already has feelings of social pressure and influence.
Like, really?
You know, well, why can't so-and-so play with me longer? Well, we're at a play date, but he's spending more time with the other kid. You know, things like that. That's already happening at his age.
How do you go about introducing the whole thing with a child to a phone? Is there any data that shows there's an age that's appropriate or not, or does it depend on the child?
I think it really depends on the child. And I was actually having this conversation, interestingly, with my child's optometrist last week. And, you know, she has a toddler and she's like, well, any parent who can not give their kid any screen time, kudos to them, because I don't know how that's possible. That's probably pretty hard to do. She's like, but more importantly, if you're trying to protect their eyes, and she's talking obviously about their eye health, she's like, well, you just want to keep things at a certain distance, you know, make sure they're not looking at it too closely. And of course, like, take breaks. I think that every family is going to have their idea about this, because there are health and mental health effects of having too much screen time too young. But I also think that when parents judge other parents for having their child use screen time, you know, that's not very helpful, because I think that most people need it just to get a break. Like, if you want to wash the dishes or clean up before bedtime, you know, you need to have, you know, YouTube babysitter maybe for like 20 minutes while you're doing all of that. And so I think you have to watch your child. And if your child is showing signs of distress when you try to take away the phone, the YouTube, they're protesting too much, they're starting to act out of sorts, you know, that kind of shows you that they're having some kind of an addiction to it. And it doesn't mean that it's clinical addiction. I'm not trying to diagnose your three-year-old child, but it's more like, wow, if they're having this big of a reaction when you try to take away their phone, and they're not like, you know, okay, I don't really want to, but I'll do it, then I think that you're starting to see a problem develop. And that's when you really have to be more strict about enforcing limits and explaining to your child in a way that they can understand their age. Like, it's not great for you to watch, you know, the phone for this long. Let's play something else. Let's do something else. And really making sure that there's variety in their activities.
Somebody texted in, I was talking about Breaking Bad, and they said that smartphones are the electronic crystal meth. We're going to talk about the addictive nature of these things when we come back. Dr. Judy Ho is our friend, our guest, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast. Text me at 504-260-1870. If you got kids in school, tell me how you handle their phone usage, how you monitor it, and do you check their phones? Because, again, back in the day, it used to be, let's check to see what you're looking at, predators, keystroke programs, etc. But now it seems as though the conversation has shifted from that to bullying and your friends trashing you on social media, or the thing of thinking everybody's life is better than yours because you're seeing this little 12-second snippet that in no way is real life. 504-260-1870 if you want to get involved. 937 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 944 16 till 10. Talking to our friend Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, about smartphones and parents and kids. And Dr. Judy, somebody texted in and said they want to go through their kid's phone to see what they're up to. Talking about a 15-year-old girl here, but the kid being the 15-year-old girl, but they don't know what to look for. And that's a good point, because I mentioned back in the day it used to be, you know, predators or maybe, you know, Chris Hansen and looking for some old guy trying to pick him up or something like that. But now there's a lot more threats than that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it can be really tough because there's a new app coming out all the time, and it's just impossible for you to always be fully informed on everything that's going on. But, you know, there are some websites for parents to know about kids' apps, basically. And I don't know that they're always going to be 100% ahead of the game, but there's several different websites that essentially educate parents about the kind of apps that are out there. There's also some parental control apps to manage screen time and how they access things. But, you know, I think the most important thing is if your child is living under your roof, then there has to be certain rules. Like, I can check their phone anytime I want, and I need to have passwords to all of your apps. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to ask, because it's your money, it's your house, right? They're living with your rules. And if they want to have a phone, then as a balance to that privilege, you need to be able to have access to anything that you want to look at. So if you, you know, of course, it doesn't prevent them from trying to delete an app before you go and look at it. But still, if you're looking at their phone and you're trying to get into an app and you can't open it, you know, you can request that they put their password in so you can look at it. And I think that that's very reasonable. I don't think that that's overbearing, because I think that you need to have parental monitoring. I think you and I have talked about this before, Tommy, but parental monitoring is one of the biggest predictors of good functioning in children and adolescents. You know, just the fact that you're on top of what they're doing and you're asking questions.
Somebody texted in about the addictive part of it, the difference between habit and addiction, and is there anything that indicates, and I know you and I have had this conversation before, but with dopamine and so forth, there is an addictive nature to whatever it is that social media is feeding you through the phone, right?
Yes, definitely. And it's because the quickness of how you get emotional and sensory rewards from using phone and apps and how they're designed, they are a bit unnatural in a way, right? It's not giving your dopamine sort of the type of spike that it would regularly have if it was just exposed to, you know, a really fun activity, a great meal, a great laugh with your friends. Like, there's dopamine spikes there too, but they don't spike it so quickly. And, you know, I think some researchers, which I think they're trying to make a point, it sounds very severe, but what they're saying is the level of dopamine spikes in terms of how significant they are, they're starting to replicate in some ways what alcohol and substances do when we use them. And so this is the part of the addictive nature, or like gambling, for example, or internet gaming, like all of these activities that have shown to have addictive qualities. It's because they spike the dopamine in such a large magnitude that your brain then starts to become addicted to that, right? It's not satisfied anymore the next time you just have a great laugh with your friends or go out for a nice meal. It wants that bigger dopamine kick. And then your brain starts to get more and more used to that. So your brain builds tolerance and it needs to be bigger and better the next time. And so, and the apps are always trying to make them bigger and better because they want your attention. And so, you know, we're not making app makers out to be like horrible human beings. I mean, obviously there's great apps out there too, but they are trying to tap into that particular, you know, human drive of wanting to feel good. And dopamine is a feel good as well as a motivational chemical. So it motivates you to do that same behavior next time to get that same high, if you will.
Somebody texted in and wants to know the best way to go about their kid getting some negative feedback from friends on social media.
Yeah, it's really hard, right? Because I think that that's going to happen to everybody who uses social media at any point. And I think it's really important to normalize the behavior, but not discount it. So, you know, yes, you know, this is not, you're not the only person this is happening to, but not like this is no big deal, right? So you're not the only person that this is happening to, you know, but we know you're suffering. And what can we do to help you with that? You know, is it better that you just kind of take a break and don't look at it for a little while? Is it that maybe you need to reevaluate who are your real friends if they're saying this about you? Or do you want to actually have a direct talk about whoever's spreading this rumor if you have that relationship with them? I think it's important to help them problem solve it, but without actually doing it for them. And the answer might not be just, you know, well, this is why we don't use social media. I mean, that's not really a great lesson. I think that that's also unrealistic for most people. They're going to use social media. And so it's more about like, how can we use it in a way that's more responsible? And if these people are toxic, if these people are making you feel this way, then do you want to be friends with them? You know, like, do you want to rethink your friendship, maybe hang out with another group of people who might not say this about you behind your back or to your face on social media? And I think that that will help at least start the conversation.
Well, they are a family, so no, I'm kidding. When it comes to the age thing and kids, somebody texted in, basically what they're asking is it possible to raise a child today without a smartphone, because they're going to be kind of like left out of the loop, right?
Yeah, but I also know that there's a lot of people who don't give their teens smartphones, and they're just used to that as a way of life. And it, you know, you can give them a phone for emergencies, right? They should be able to contact you when they need you, but they don't need a smartphone for that, right? And so I think that you might feel like your child is missing out. They may tell you that they're missing out, but I also know many parents who are successfully raising their teens and their teens don't have phones and they're doing really well. And so I think it's really about your own parenting philosophy and also maybe reevaluating your own anxiety about it. Like, do you think that you're not going to, you know, be on top of everything if they don't have a phone? Or is it that, you know, you don't want them to miss out, but it's your anxiety that's overriding the fact that there are kids living without phones? So I would say talk to parents who have done it both ways. You know, if you need a little bit more advice or just guidance on what works, talk to some parents who don't give their kids phones and see how they manage and how their kids are doing.
I want to do a quick poll here at 504-260-1870. If y'all know of any teenagers that don't have a phone, because I don't. Do you, Dr. Judy?
I do, yeah.
You do, really?
Yeah, I can think of literally five families off of the top
really?
Of my head right now.
Teenagers kids, with
I mean,
no phones?
Their child. Yep, and they're like 14, 15 years old. Their kids are between the ages of 13 to 15, and they don't have phones. They don't have smartphones.
Anybody's doing fine?
They just borrow their parents' phones to do things. Yeah, they'll like use their parents' phone to text their friends. You know, they'll play games on their parents' phone. I've seen them do that.
Somebody else texted in. They said, what's the best way to handle being involved in a negative chat? Do you call the other people out or do you just not take part in it?
Yeah, I mean,
I guess they're talking about where five people are on a chat.
Yeah.
Trash and yeah. The sixth person that's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it was me, I would say something, but not to shame people. I would just say, hey, like, I'd rather not talk about that. Or like, that's pretty mean, guys. I mean, I wouldn't make a big deal out of it, but I would kind of call them out at least to say, I don't like this behavior and I'm not going to participate in it. But I also think that it's totally fair if you want to really confront them about it and maybe not even on the chat, maybe the next time you see them, that's another way to have that conversation, because otherwise people get defensive, right? Especially in a group environment. And then the other thing is, if it feels better, just ignore it and not be part of it. Don't be part of that chat. When they're talking that way, that's okay too. I think that's defensible. But if you have a feeling about it and you don't want to be part of that, there's different ways so that you don't have to be complicit in that behavior. And, you know, it's a little bit like groupthink. One person will say something mean, the other person says it, and the ha-ha, everybody's laughing about it, and then people just kind of keep going. And I think that is how gossip starts, and that is how you hurt people, because eventually the person you're talking about finds out about it.
Is there a rule of thumb when it comes to time, or is that all individual?
I think it's individual, but you need to also realize that so much of it is about variety. So sometimes people will say, well, but my kids finished their homework, so I just let them play video games for 4 hours. I mean, there's 4 hours of free time. If there's 4 hours of free time, not all of it needs to be video games, right? It could be 1 hour video games and 3 hours of other things. And so the biggest thing is about variety, to stimulate your brain in different ways other than with this kind of unnatural way that's very stimulating and very fun, but also, you know, you need to be able to walk away from that. So I don't know if you know this about me, Tommy, but I really love video games. But mm-hmm. Thankfully, I tend to like the video games where you can dip in and out of them, like the old school, like Street Fighter or Tekken games, like things that you kind of play naturally for 15, 20 minutes and it's easy to step out of it. Mm-hmm. But obviously right now, there's so many games that are so involved, and apps are like this too. And the app game, you can play an app game for 6 hours. And so setting a timer is a good way to do it when you're a parent and just say, you got 30 minutes of phone time, go ahead, you know, and just kind of making that a routine. I think that can be really helpful. And then having other activities around so that they can choose other things to do, and giving them a couple of options.
If you don't want them to do it, don't do it yourself.
Yeah, you're still modeling it for them, right? So if you're saying, hey, you can't use the phone for 4 hours, but you are, you're using the phone for 4 hours and it's not for work, then I think you need to evaluate where you can really set your own limits so that your child can follow your example.
Are these behaviors any different than they used to be, or just magnified because of social media?
I think that there's an actual difference, because there just wasn't access to this kind of thing before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was a teenager, we started using dial-up modems to get online. That was a huge breakthrough. But before then, we weren't at our computers that much, you know? I mean, we played like Oregon Trail. Do you remember that? That was a game on the computer.
You had to actually work.
But it's such a slow,
if you want
but
to trash
it's a slow
somebody.
Game.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's too much work. So it's a completely qualitatively different thing that we're dealing with now.
Thank you, Dr. Judy. I appreciate it. As always, Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, 956. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.